So, welcome. Thank you so incredibly much for coming out tonight and for being willing to even contemplate this subject. I already know that you are courageous because this is a tough subject. One more question. Raise your hand on the inside if your heart is broken. Or the outside. Okay, thank you. It is a very tough topic. So tonight I would like to dive into that topic. I would like to give short meditation instruction, if that's okay. So we'll start together with a little bit of practice. Very short. Then I'll talk about some ideas about what would happen if someone tried to apply the Buddhist view to the idea, to the topic of heartbreak. Then we'll have some kind of a conversation. I'll probably talk for about 20 minutes or so, and then we'll talk. Sound okay? So we come from different places, and there are three steps that we can do together to sort of harmonize this room. And I'm going to ask you all to sing a little song. No, not really. That would be so mean. There are three steps that we can do together, and there's three steps that you can do anywhere to sort of create a sacred environment, so to speak, whatever that might mean to you. Like, this room is built to contain a certain kind of sacred experience. So we're going to create a container ourselves in this room through these three steps. And the first one is called making offerings. So this shrine here has offerings on it that represent various things. The senses, basically. But you can offer anything in your home or right now. The best thing to offer always is your experience as it is right now. And right now. And right now. So if you would, just connect with whatever it is that is you right now and offer that. And who do you offer it to? And this is the second step, which is called requesting blessings. So you request the blessings of your lineage, in this particular case represented by these photographs and this painting. So if you're a Shambhala Buddhist, you request the blessings of our lineage. But each of us is part of a lineage. And it may be Christian, it may be atheist, you may be part of the lineage of mothers, of poets, of lovers, of Italians, of gardeners, engineers, whatever you consider your lineage, because you didn't get here by accident. You're a link in a particular chain or chains. So think of what your lineage is. And the great beings who have gone before in your lineage, and request their blessings. So the third step is called to dedicate the merit, but I'll explain that, and we're going to do that at the very end. But in between will be our practice, which will be our conversation and our meditation. Are there any questions so far? Is this what you came here to hear about? Pretty much. As far as you know right now, you can reserve the right to change your mind. So the meditation practice that we're going to do is called shamatha meditation. And shamatha is a Sanskrit word that means peacefully abiding, or the practice of tranquility. So I know that there are people here who have probably a lot of experience with this practice. And there may be people here who do a different kind of meditation practice. But I'd like to ask us all to do the same practice. For experienced practitioners, as we know, we can never hear the instructions too many times. So sort of pretend you're hearing it for the first time, and even if you've heard it 100,000 times, maybe the 100,000 first time you'll attain complete realization. And if so, please raise your hand. And for people that do another practice, please try this practice anyway, because it will be very supportive to the others in the room if we're all doing the same practice. So again, shamatha. It's 2,500 years old. It's been used by millions of people over thousands of years to very good effect. So you can trust this practice. And I did not make it up in my room last night. That's why I'm trying to tell you that it's rooted. So the practice, one way to think of the practice is that it begins with three kinds of mindfulness. The first is mindfulness of body. So the practice begins with the way you take your seat. The basic idea is to sit up straight. Just because, you know, we all know the difference between this and this. It feels different. So if you're seated on the floor, your legs are crossed loosely in front of you, or you're kneeling. And if you're on a chair, try to have your feet flat on the floor. And if possible, sit forward so you're not leaning on anything. Unless that's uncomfortable, don't do it. And sit up straight, but not straight like a steel rod stuck in the ground. Or like someone's just said, you've been a very bad boy or girl, sit up straight. Not that kind of straight. This straight is more like a tree. Trees are firmly planted. They don't get up and move around. And if it helps, you can imagine that you are buried up to your waist in soil. And everything below is your root system. And up from that, like the trunk and branches of a tree, blossoms your trunk and your limbs and your head. So there's a sense of being firmly planted, but also responsive and alive. The hands are palms down, just above the knees or at mid-thigh. And there shouldn't be a sense that you're holding yourself up or pushing yourself back. And let your belly relax. More. And let your shoulders relax. The chin is tucked a little bit to bring some length to the back of the neck, and the mouth is closed, but the teeth can be slightly parted if that helps the jaw to relax. Imagine that someone you love is holding their palm just above the crown of your head by a few centimeters. And you want to feel their touch because you like them so much or love them so much. So reach up a little bit with the crown. And notice how simultaneously your crown is reaching up and your sit bones are reaching down. And in this way, you join heaven and earth. In this practice, the eyes remain open and the gaze is cast down to a spot about 6 or 8 feet in front, and it doesn't matter what's in that spot. Just let your gaze rest there as if what you were looking at was coming forward to be seen. We reach out with our eyeballs all day long to grab whatever's on a screen or someone's face or in a book or whatever it might be. But this is not that kind of looking. This is almost as much looking in as looking out. So Pretend that your eyeballs could drop back a little bit in the sockets while vision streams forth. Please notice your own natural elegance in this posture. And this is mindfulness of body. Now bring your attention to your breath as it comes in and out through your nose. There's no need to breathe in any particular way. Just let your attention ride your breath. And that's different than thinking about your breath. One way to note that difference is to do this without moving or looking. Let your awareness hover around your left knee. Just notice it. Maybe you feel the strain of fabric or cool air, or it's a little achy, or it doesn't feel like much of anything. And now, without moving or looking, move your attention to your right ear. And just notice it. Whatever just moved between your knee and your ear, that is your attention, and that is what you place on your breath. So please do so. Come all the way in with the in-breath. Don't miss a moment of it. Try to pick out the very moment it becomes the out-breath and ride that out all the way like a wave. And notice the little gap at the end of the exhalation and how the next inhalation simply arises. The amount of effort that's required is zero. And this is mindfulness of breath. At some point, it could happen that your attention is drawn away from breath and knees and ears and becomes absorbed instead in thought. And that is not a problem. A big misconception about meditation is that it involves emptying the mind of thought, which is pretty much impossible. Like opening the eyes and telling them not to see. It'd be very, very frustrating. So instead, we just allow our thoughts to float by like clouds in the sky while the majority of our attention is on the breath. And just like clouds, some thoughts are heavy. Some are so far off you can barely see them. Some are beautiful. Some are ominous. Some are just normal. In our daily life, we are very accustomed to identifying ourselves as the clouds. This thought, that thought. But in this practice, we identify as the sky. Which can hold it all. Never gives up. And this is mindfulness of mind. So we have mindfulness of body, which brings a quality of stability. And mindfulness of breath, which brings a sense of peace. And mindfulness of mind, which brings the quality of vast spaciousness. This is who you are, and this is the practice. So we'll practice together for just a few minutes. When your mind becomes absorbed in thought, as soon as you notice, just let that thought go. And here's the important word. Gently bring your attention back to your breath with kindness towards yourself. To bring this short practice to a close, hold your posture, but stop meditating. Just let the technique go. And come back. Thank you very much. That was a lovely practice. Okay, on with the show. Tonight, obviously, we're here to talk about heartbreak. And what we will find is that that is no different than talking about love. Talking about heartbreak and talking about love turn out to be the same thing. So I would like to ask you, I usually ask everyone in the room to say this one word, but I think we have too many people to do that. So instead, think this word. Come up with what for you is a euphemism for heartbreak. Some word that to you means heartbreak. Let's get five people to volunteer their word.
Grief.
Pain. Mm-hmm.
Sorrow.
Loss.
Separateness. Yes, all good words. So I suggest during this talk that you hold your word as a contemplation. And all that means is you take your word and you stick it in your head and you forget about it. And you see if it sort of bounces around at any point during the talk or in your life, basically. And the one thing I want to say about your word before we go on to my words is something about your word is your friend. Although it feels quite dreadful, and legitimately so, there is something about your word that is your friend, that can help you. So you can figure out what that is. So my interest in this topic starts with my own broken heart, certainly. And I just will tell you a brief story about that broken heart. This is about heartbreak from lost love. Just P.S. It applies to other kinds of heartbreak, but this is specifically about the loss of love. And that kind of heartbreak, and I'm going to get to my story in one second, has qualities that other kinds of heartbreak don't seem to have. I mean, with all kinds of sorrow, there's, remorse, perhaps, or loss, deep grief, anger maybe even. And those things certainly come with heartbreak from lost love. But this has other qualities too. And they include things like shame, just unbelievable sense that of worthlessness, that if this one person doesn't want you, that you are unwantable by basically all of humanity. And no matter how many times you try to prop yourself up, something comes along and knocks that down. And basically you go through the day, I'm speaking from personal experience, with every single thing that happens, every conversation, every advertisement, every email, is either confirmation of your worthlessness or some kind of clue that maybe you're not completely worthless. But basically the world shrinks down to that issue, shame. There are also mood swings that are out of control. And I'm sort of laughing a little bit because it's not funny. That's not why I'm laughing. But it is quite amazing what can cause a normal person who thinks they're pretty much okay to fall apart. So whether your heartbreak was last night or 10 years ago, and heartbreak has no time limit, you can be walking around going, oh, yeah, I'm pretty okay. I probably moved on. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm sad about it, but okay. And then you see a kitten or something, and you completely fall apart. You start sobbing because he or she had a kitten right before you broke up, and that kitten reminds you of all kittens and kittens you will never have, and you just fall apart. So those kind of mood swings that are quite unpredictable. And then the third quality, and I'm sure there are others, and if you know what they are, you can volunteer them. Oh, and by the way, if you have any questions about the practice, please hold them till the end, and I would like to answer those as best I can. Obsessive thinking. Obsessive thinking. I don't have to explain what that is. If I didn't do this, and if I hadn't worn pink, and if I had only not had those pants, or taken Saturdays off of work, or whatever it might be. I guess toasty, getting toasty. This relationship would still be happening. And so these thoughts come to you while you're awake, and they come to you while you're asleep. I remember when I was in the thick of it, I was in a relationship where I knew it wasn't the right relationship for me somehow, but I loved this person, and he loved me. And my book, by the way, is about all the pronouns and stuff are like for women who love men, but that was just for ease of use, so it's for anybody who loves anybody. So we would break up and get back together, break up and get back together, and there's a deep connection, very deep. And I was usually the one doing the breaking up. In fact, I was always the one doing the breaking up, now that I think of it. But one time we broke up and he started going out with someone else. And my world collapsed. I still can't really explain to this day why. So you have relationships. Everybody has relationships that end. And you, to one degree or another, you feel sad. You know, even desperately sad for some weeks or months. But then you move on. But there are some kinds of heartbreak that you don't move on from. They stop you. They shatter you. And this was that kind of heartbreak. And I don't have to explain what that means to any of you, I'm sure. Because when you've experienced it, you know what it is. So one day, I was crying a lot and taking out the trash. And I was obsessing and I was crushed. You people, I was crushed. And I never thought I would get over it. So I'm pulling the trash down to the curb, crying, and thinking, why? Why did this happen to me? And if only we had met 5 years earlier or 5 years later, it probably could have worked out. And I bet he's with her right now. And they're probably laughing at me. And I don't think I can handle this. And on and on and on and on, taking the trash out. And so I got down to the curb with the trash, and I sat down on the curb with the garbage. And I really thought to myself, maybe when the trash people come, they could throw me away too. Because I don't think I can handle it. Maybe they could compact me into some little, you know, piece of something that could then just poof, go away. And so literally at this moment, this is the truth, I heard a voice, presumably inside my own head. I don't know where else it would come from. And that voice said, wait a minute. Well, it didn't really say wait a minute. I added that part. That voice said, but nothing is happening right now. That was startling to me. That stopped my mind. And I looked around, and it was so. Nothing was happening. No one was destroying my future. No one was laughing at me. No one was telling me they wished I'd done this instead of that. Nobody was saying anything, because no one was there. So in that moment, I had this sense of incredible liberation, peace. And the sense that underneath everything, my heartbreak, the garbage, the sunlight, whatever it might be, is this stillness. Complete stillness that is also alive. It is warm. And it's always there. In fact, I use silence as a sort of silence to reconjure that. Like, you can always hear silence with your ears, even if you're in a football stadium. So you can always tune your ear to silence. So there's a sense that you could tune your whole being to silence. And so this quality of release lasted for maybe 12 seconds. And then it all came back like running into a brick wall again. But I never forgot that, obviously. And I realized in that moment that it was not my circumstances that were causing me such sorrow. It was my mind. And if I could somehow learn to work with my mind, I could heal my heart. That turns out to be the truth. And we're going to talk about how come. You with me? Okay. Anybody not with me? Okay. When I started studying Buddhism, and that was in 1995, I started to learn more about not just what this silence meant, but what this heartbreak meant. Because surprisingly, in Buddhism, is in this lineage, Shambhala Buddhism, courtesy of Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, and now his son, Sakyam Mipham Rinpoche, there are extraordinary teachings on heartbreak. Who knew? And the most interesting thing about these teachings is they're about spiritual warriorship, like how to really be an authentic, amazing human being who exists for the benefit of others and to give everything. That's a spiritual warrior, I guess one way of saying it. To be that kind of person, you must have a broken heart. That's what the book said. And that if you don't have a broken heart, your warriorship is not trustworthy. So that was the first time that I thought, oh, this is actually could be good. I don't really get it, but okay. This is better than thinking this is horrible. And all the teachings in Shambhala Buddhism are about how to turn towards that heartbreak, as opposed to all the teachings in the conventional world, which are about how to turn away from it. So just as a little aside, I would like to say that I discovered there are two kinds of breakup books out there, and they're all geared towards women. So that's why this example sounds like it does. And the first one is called, I like to call, You Go Girl! And that's the kind of book that says, you are probably just too awesome for that person. And you should move on. You should try to think the right thoughts and get maybe a cute haircut and some cocktails and move on. I don't think that is particularly helpful, but I don't think that's bad advice. But not bad advice. The second kind is kind of bad. And that's the kind of book that says there's something wrong with you. Not you, but you and you and you. There's something wrong with you. And you brought this on yourself. You made this happen by carrying forward into your adult life an unhealed wound and or by thinking the wrong thoughts. And if you could only heal that wound and think the right thoughts, you would never have to feel pain again. This troubles me very much. This is bad advice. It assumes that the sorrow is not supposed to be a part of your life. Sorrow is so rich. It assumes that you know what's best for you, which may sound weird, but who hasn't had the experience of thinking something's going to be good and it turns out to be awful, and vice versa? The world is so much bigger than that. It's so much bigger than you going, I need to think positive all the time and suck out all the bad thoughts. There's so much more to being a human being than that. So I don't like that advice. But in this tradition, the advice is open to it. Turn towards it. It's important. But how do you do that? So I'm going to explain some ideas about how you could. So, but first, when you think about heartbreak, and this may sound weird, but when you study the Dharma, you're sort of introduced, this is going to connect, and it might not make sense why I'm saying this, but it'll make sense in a second. We talk about the three jhana view, and this is how the path progresses. The first jhana, which means vehicle, they said that the Buddha turned the wheel of Dharma three times, gave three big sets of teachings. And the first set is called the Hinayana, which means lesser vehicle or foundational vehicle. And those are the teachings that you would expect someone to give if they just discovered a religion. Just like they're about personal conduct and how to get your own life in order. Because that's where every path has to start. It's the same with heartbreak. You have to get yourself together. So once you do, once you basically stabilize your world, the second set of teachings come into play. Because what happens at that point, and this is just how we're built, your heart naturally flowers open to other people. When you feel pretty stable in your own life, you open to people in a different way than when you don't feel stable. And so the second round of teachings are about love. They're about compassion. They're about emptiness, which somehow is the same thing as compassion. Not sure how, but it is. This is useful in heartbreak too. And then the third jhana is called Vajrayana, or diamond, indestructible vehicle. And these are the teachings that say your basic personal life is pretty okay. You know how to open to other people. Now your whole life is a path. And everything that arises, you can see as your path. So that's just one way of looking at it. So when it comes to heartbreak, it's very useful to apply the three jhana view to your own healing process. So beginning with foundational vehicle, get yourself in order. That doesn't mean stop feeling pain. That means pare down all non-essential activities so you can really pay attention to this, because it's big. Deserves your attention. So the advice about being busy and distracting yourself, you want to forget about that for a while because you want to focus on it. So pare your life down to only essential activities, essential people. Essential people in this case are the ones who can befriend you while you're in pain. And they may be the people you thought were your friends, and they may be other people. The essential people are not the ones that tell you how to get over it. Like, you should learn to meditate, or you should get a different job, or you should stop eating dairy, or whatever it is that people say that they think is going to heal you. You don't. That's not your friend right now. Your friend is the person who will be with you. And learn to tame your mind, which doesn't mean empty it or stop bad thoughts. It means learn how to relax with this extraordinary, rushing, overwhelming flow of thoughts. The more you try to fight it, the stronger it's going to come back. So the only choice here is to relax. And relax in this case means allow. Because there's nothing more relaxing than allowing. Right? So I don't know how one would do it without the practice of meditation, but perhaps there are other ways, but I suggest that you learn a basic meditation like what we just did, or use it, even if you've already learned it. And then the second phase, look at your heart. This is where the teachings on warriorship really come into a little sharper focus. Because what you have here is a heart that can feel everything. Your heart may be broken, but it is broken open. And you can feel everything. You can feel your own feelings, certainly, but you feel the sorrow of others. You feel the joy of others, whether you know them or not. And this is a kind of, you know, compassion when you feel their sorrow, or sympathetic joy when you feel their joy. It's without thought. It's automatic. You don't go, oh, that must be, that would make a person happy. I'm happy for you. There's, that intermediate step is gone, and you feel it directly. And you are keenly attuned to the presence or absence of love in every moment. And you know, beyond doubt, that the only thing that matters is love. I'm going to keep pointing. And that is true. So if you have a person that can feel everything, feels everybody's everything, is attuned to love, and knows that that's the only important thing, what have we here? Oh, I think that's a bodhisattva, an awakened being. I mean, that's one way to think of an awakened being, someone who can feel everything, who's attuned to love, and knows that this is the only important thing. And love has an extremely giant definition in this case. So this is beautiful. There is incredible beauty in this heartbreak, because your heart, in a sense, has never been more alive. And it also feels like crap. I'm not trying to downplay that. That is the truth. But there's something else going on, too. In a sense, it's what it feels like when all the capability you have to love, which is a lot, and you see it now, is liberated from its object, has no object to attach to, because that person is gone. So, boom, it just floats and zooms and crashes and seeps and runs and jumps and whatever else it might do. You feel how big your own heart is, unattached to an object. So the trick at this stage is to learn not to close your heart, because there are only two choices, by the way, close or open. But to stabilize your heart in the open state. You can do that. The practice of loving kindness teaches you how. And there's a traditional practice, and it's in the book, my book, and I have instruction on my site, and there are many wonderful books about loving kindness meditation. Great authors have written about it. Or you can just practice loving kindness in your own way by thinking, just taking a moment and thinking of someone or something that you love, and just wishing that someone or something well. You can do it by being nice, to everyone you encounter in some way, which doesn't mean being a wuss. It just means sort of being attuned to what another person might be experiencing and trying to offer something that could be useful to them. Sometimes it's useful to give a hug, sometimes it's useful to ignore. Useful is different in every circumstance. So at this point, you start to make a very important transition in your work with heartbreak. And that's to start, this is the secret healing formula. And that is to start to shift your gaze ever so slightly away from your need for love, which is potent and real, onto your need to give love, which is equally as potent and real. In this way, you assume the seat of power, not control, but power in relation to your own heart. You take the seat of a lover in this way. When you try to give love in whatever way you can, in every moment, and you can always do it in every moment. And this heals. This is the healing method, ladies and gentlemen. By the way, all the books about love, some of which are profound and fantastic, are all about how to get it. Zero are about how to give it. I think that's kind of strange. But we live in a world, for whatever reason, where our idea is we're going to get love, and then we will give it. But you can reverse that. You can totally reverse that. You can give it, and then you'll get it. It's pretty simple. But for some reason, we don't think about it. You know, myself certainly included. Does that make sense?
Giving love. Mm-hmm. Shifting the focus.
Mm-hmm. So it's a great question, and you can shift, you can do that, but you can't do it right now. So the first step would be to turn your attention to that fatigue, just to notice it, to make room for it, to feel it, even to take it as the object of your meditation, like you take breath as the object of meditation in shamatha practice. Take your fatigue as the object of your meditation. Just keep bringing your attention to it, not to try to squish it, but just to know it, and then see what happens. So in this way, you try to befriend yourself. Like if someone you knew was suffering like you're suffering, you would just be like, what do you need from me? What can I do? And I want to help you, and I care about you, and when things go well for them, you perk up. And when things go poorly for them, you feel bad. But how often do you ever do that for yourself? So you could do that. Yes?
I think the difficulty is making that switch from obsessiveness to the practice that you're talking about. I'm sure when I think back to being in that state, I could not get past obsessiveness.
I'm going to repeat this. The question is about obsessiveness, and how do you get from that, like it seems impossible to get beyond that and do this practice of mindfulness. Is that pretty much what you asked? So at this point, your obsessiveness is your practice. It is your meditation. And you, I don't mean you put your mind on your obsessiveness, but you put your mind on your breath, and in one half of one millionth of a second, you start thinking about something else. And maybe for an hour, and then you notice it, and then you come back. And it lasts for half a second. I know it sounds awful and quite labor-intensive, but it heals. I should say, try it and see if it heals. Because you should take everything. I'm making everything up that I'm telling you. So you should take it with a giant grain of salt and try it yourself. But Pema Chodron said the exact pith instruction for the question you're asking, and I'm really mad at her because this is my whole book said in one sentence. But that sentence is feel the feeling and drop the story. Okay, good night. That's okay. Pass advice. Feel the feeling and drop the story. And that has many effects. The first of which, it's quite expeditious. It aids the metabolization process of this pain. It's also kind. It's a kind thing to do for yourself. So the third phase, you get your life together by practicing, you try to pare your life down. You do practices to stabilize your heart in the open state. At this point, something happens, I think. And you notice that there's some kind of profound wisdom in your life and in you and in this experience. Not in the conventional sense of this is here to teach you a lesson so you can that you need so you can go on and conquer love in some other way. There's a wisdom that is sort of unconditional, ungraspable, but you know it. Like everybody, I'm sure, has had the experience of seeing a day or an experience or a year where you notice that your life is a path. It's going somewhere, or something is happening. So you take your entire life as your path when your heart is broken. So the practices that aid in this are, I already said, mindfulness meditation, loving kindness meditation, and the view of life as path. There's an incredible opportunity when your heart is broken to know yourself and to cultivate a deeper ability to love. And I know that might sound implausible, but it's true. So you learn that there is, fortunately or unfortunately, no way to make love safe. And when most people say they want love, you know, me too, I'm not talking about other people, what they really mean is they want to be safe. They want some sort of shelter against loneliness, against old age, against financial problems, against whatever, just boringness of being alone. And good, you should all have that. We should all have that. But that I would not call that love. So we should call it what it is, which is something else. So because love can't be tamed. You can't game it. It's bigger than you. So all you can do is like rejoice when it's there and grieve when it's not and remain open. So one of my big learnings in writing this book was you can't make it safe. And in fact, this is going to sound like a real bummer, but it kind of is and it kind of isn't. There is no relationship that will not end in heartbreak. Did I just say that? You know, someone's going to break up with someone, or someone's going to die. So as practitioners, and in some way everyone in this room is a practitioner, whether it's a formal practice or not, here's a question you have to ask yourself. As Buddhists, for the Buddhists in the room, first noble truth, life is suffering. I don't think it means everything sucks. I think it just means everything changes. I hope that's not what it means. And the second noble truth is everything changes. So, okay, I don't know about everybody else, but I can pretty much work with that or try to when it comes to everything but love. I can't hold the mind of meditation, which allows things to arise, abide, and dissolve, I cannot hold that mind to love for more than a little while because it's too painful. And in a sense, the more you love, the more painful it is. And anyone who's a parent knows this. You see the preciousness of this other person, and oftentimes all you can feel is their vulnerability and how desperately you want to protect them. And if you have a long-term relationship, I think, and you love, that moment of eventual parting gets stronger and stronger with every iota of love deepening. That's hard to relate to. And my personal belief, this is armchair analysis from someone who just hangs out in her room thinking about things. This is why most relationships fail. It's because it's too hard to confront that. And it's easier at some point in a relationship to say, well, you threw your socks on the floor, or you don't have a good enough sense of humor, or whatever it is, you know, to avoid that clear scene. So this is where warriorship happens, is you know it can't be safe. You know it's inevitable that your heart's going to break, and you love anyway. Who does not want to be loved by someone like that? Who's doing it for you? That's a big person. And you can all be that person. And not like it or not, when in heartbreak, you have a clear view of exactly what I'm talking about. And you have a choice to dive into this lover without net kind of life. Does that make sense? Another way to look at it is, heartbreak is inevitable, so you can relax. Take it easy. So the last thing I want to say before we have any kind of conversation, actually, let me look at my notes, because I'm kind of tired. When we study Buddhism, we learn about threefold logic. Everything has threefold logic. Whatever it is you're doing, you're taking a new job, or you're reading the newspaper, or you're taking a drink of water, there's a ground. Say, you know, you're watching TV. The ground is you want to watch a program. There's a path. You turn the TV on. There's a fruition. You find out who won the game, or whatever it is that is on the TV. So ground, path, and fruition. So what would it be? What is the ground, path, and fruition of heartbreak? I'm going to tell you what I think it is. But it's a very interesting question to pose to yourself. Ground, path, and fruition. Because everything has a ground, a path, and a fruition. Or at least believe that for the sake of this conversation. The ground of heartbreak is pain. All the words that you have in your head, that's the ground. That's where you start. That's where you stand. It's where you begin. The path is awareness. How much can you turn your attention to yourself, your feelings? How much can you open to it? How much can you work with the idea of love? How much can you take in your longing to be loved? How much can you open to it? How much awareness can you bring to it? How much of that thing that you put on your knee and your ear and your breath can you put on your heart? Awareness is the path. And the fruition is love. You learn how to love in this very powerful way. So I think that's my talk. But I would love to hear questions so we can have a conversation. But I would like to ask what time it is, because I don't want to keep... Oh, it's midnight. Oh, oops. 10 after 8. Okay, so we're good. Yes.
Yeah,
Could you just repeat briefly again why most relationships fail?
Yes, I could repeat that. Because it's too hard to confront the moment of parting that is inevitable. That's hard. So, just one little note about that is to love like that, to stay, you have to hold pain and love together in the same moment. I believe that's the definition of compassion. The ability to hold pain, isn't that what it feels like? And love at the same time.
And I was thinking about the Philosopher's Stone.
I love this. I'm going to repeat this for you in the back.
And how the alchemists were not trying to turn base metal into gold. It was about the spiritual quest. Mm-hmm. And that felt so connected to that concept of the Philosopher's Stone and building that hardness, the gold within.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the image. I was looking at the gold on the altar. And
I love that. What came to her mind was the analogy of alchemy, the science of alchemy, the ancient science, of turning base metals into gold. And that there's a philosopher's stone. That is that where you start? And I think that's a very apt analogy. And in fact, I wrote about alchemy in my book. Boom! That in the alchemist's gig is to take the base substance and convert it into something precious, but the first step is to make it what they call volatile. So you sort of shake it up, so to make ice into steam or whatever, you make the base substance a version of itself, but it's volatile, so you can have impact on it. So you, when your heart is broken, are in a state of sacred volatility. And there, you know, you might as well use it, you know, in a kind way. I totally agree with you. Thank you. What else? Questions or comments or confusements or anything whatsoever? Wishes? Jokes?
Okay. Mm-hmm. What about when the pain, when I put my attention or awareness on the pain, and there is a grieving process, but it seems like it just keeps coming. And, yeah, there's love, but there's just more and more sadness and grief, and the well seems so, so deep.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the years roll by.
Yes. The point is you turn your attention to your sadness, and it seems that it has no end. And indeed, it doesn't right now. It could go on for years. Yeah.
That's not what he wanted to hear.
I beg your pardon?
That's not what he wanted to hear.
No, that's what he said. I know. I'm just thinking about what to say about that. Did you have something that you wanted to say about that, young man in the glasses?
No.
Or is it a different topic? Okay.
Oh, and just one more anecdote, too. It isn't depression.
It isn't depression, that's true.
Because there's still states of joy and connectedness that are occurring, yet.
Yes, it isn't depression because there's still states of joy and other things, yet it's always there. So Gloria Steinem, when she was being interviewed about the death of her husband, who they were married for like 5 minutes and he died and she hadn't got... She got married when she was 60 and was really married for maybe a couple of years. And she was being interviewed about his death, and the interviewer said, "You must be depressed." And she said, "I'm not depressed. I'm sad." And I'm going to paraphrase this next thing that she said. "When you're depressed, nothing has any meaning. And when you're sad, everything does." And that is true. So I wish I could say to you that there's like a faucet that you turn on and all the sadness pours out and at some point the barrel empties. You know, I don't know if that's true. but I think it probably is. Or at least there has not yet been a state of being on in history of mankind, of personkind, that has not arisen, abided, and dissolved. There just has never been anything that hasn't changed. So it may change within a very narrow range for a long time, but eventually more changes. I hope you will be patient. You in the back, and then you in the front. Did you have something you wanted to ask?
No, I was a bit confused. I thought that was your answer to the question.
Oh, I see. That would have been a
ask something
bummer.
That, but you can answer it. So,
okay. You're welcome.
There's a quote that I have on my refrigerator that kind of speaks to it, which is that there's as much living in a moment of pain as there is in a moment of joy.
There's as much living in a moment of pain as there is in a moment of joy. That's true.
And it seems to me that that kind of speaks to that, there's that sadness, but there's still life.
It speaks to that sadness where there's still life. And that's true. So, and not only is it true, but everything that you feel that's bad is bad. But it also has an enlightened aspect. It's on a continuum with something else. It's on a continuum with its opposite. So, you know, in Buddhism we talk about changing poison into medicine. It's the same substance. Whatever is poison in a particular dosage is medicine in another dosage, you know, like in the homeopathic view. But whatever it is you feel, whatever your word was, say, you know, there's a way to look at pain as the ability to feel. There's a way to look at loss, sense of loss, as the wish to be accompanied and seen. That's a good thing. There's a way to look at grief as the ability to love. So I'm not saying you should do tricks on yourself, but just know that you're on a continuum with this beautiful thing when you feel this dreadful thing, for whatever that's worth.
Opening into this wider field of love.
Yes. the point is referring back to Pema's great pith instruction, feel the feeling and drop the story. Pema's point was that when you allow it, instead of trying to avoid it, do you use the word avoid? It starts to flow. And is that the same thing that I was saying?
Kind of large magnitude things that we're not trained well to tolerate or to get into.
Is it like a muscle you develop, that the more you're able to tolerate the heartbreak, the more you're able to tolerate or take in, you didn't use this phrase, but feel, love? I think so. I think when you chop one off, you chop the other off. I don't know who designed this system. I would like to have a word with them. But it does seem to work that way. That's a very good point. Thank you. You in the front and then you in the back.
I have a two-part question.
Mm-hmm.
Part one is, could you sum up your book in a couple of sentences?
Do you not want to buy it? I'll tell you something. I'm going to race with him. Okay, part one. What's part two?
Part two is the question. Is meditation the best way to drop the story?
Yes. To part B. Absolutely. It is the practice of dropping the story. So thank you for that question. And what my book is about is this, what we've been talking about. It's three sections. The first section is called Relax, and it's about how to allow. The second section, and there are a lot of short chapters, just like a Pema book. it's called See Where You Are. And it's chapters, and there are a lot of practices and exercises in there to bring discriminating awareness to your situation once you've relaxed with it. Because it's not just a heap of icky in there. There's something, there's intelligence going on. So see where you are. And then the third section is called be where you are. And that is self-explanatory, I think. And then there's a program in the back, the 7 days that you can do while going to your job and having your life, but of bringing these concepts and practices into your life for 7 days at least and see what happens. It's more than a few sentences, but that's what it's about. It's about the Buddhist view of heartbreak, in my opinion. Elizabeth. Oh, no, I'm sorry. In the back, and then Elizabeth.
How can we best help those who we love who have a broken heart, who are enduring grief or suffering? You know, what's your best advice about that?
Did everybody hear that? Well, it sort of depends on if we're in the basic heartbreak stage or a pathological manifestation. You know, so if a person has been lying on the couch for 9 years or is in a deep depression or has any other kind of clinical situation, then, you know, it's different advice. And it's the advice of to find experts to help. But short of that, I think it's the same answer to when people ask, I'm a practitioner and I want the people around me to practice. How do I get them to do that? When you're with someone whose heart is broken, for you to manifest wholeheartedness, which may sound kind of woo-woo, but manifest your own wholeheartedness, hold the ground of wholeheartedness beyond advice and beyond anything. Just be wholehearted. And I think that's very helpful.
I just wanted to say something about my experience with sitting practice with meditation when I was recovering from a heartbreak. Because for several months I had so much anger and so much pain, I was afraid to sit still with it. I thought I would probably completely self-destruct and yes. Self-inflame. And I couldn't sit. Mm-hmm. I was that volatile, I don't know how to describe it. Eventually, I got to a state where I felt, okay, do sit and take a look at his anger. It's not, it's still huge, but I need to take a look at it. And I finally sat, and I couldn't find it. I couldn't find it. I thought it was in my cells. I thought it was, you know, everywhere. And it wasn't in my body. It was only in the thoughts that flipped constantly, but of course it's not constant. There are breaks in it. And I could not find it. I couldn't even find pain in there. It was when I went right down to it, it was just still. So I found it was actually safe to sit with it, even though I thought it was the most dangerous thing I could do.
That's a fantastic story. Thank you. And that was very brave of you to look. It really was. Did everybody hear that? Sure. And there are some times where you can't practice. Say again?
That was the turning point.
You know, and when I've been giving talks, I've been also interviewing people on my iPhone and putting these little interviews on my website. How did you get over heartbreak? Or, you know, how did you deal with it? And almost everybody, not quite that Vajrayana-ish. But everybody says some version of, I let it happen. One day I just said,
suffering at the end of it. It's a good thought. However, just based on my experience, as you get older, sometimes those loves that you thought you lost are still very real and present in your heart, mm-hmm. and in your mind, and in your memory, in your life's experience. So my question is, after that preamble, did I miss something? How important is it to love yourself? Mm-hmm. And how do you get from being heartbroken through loving yourself to being able to go on to be mm-hmm. a risk, open-hearted warrior?
Mm-hmm. think I understand. I'm going to paraphrase, and you tell me if I've gotten it wrong, please. What role does loving yourself play in all of this? Because they say, you know, to be a warrior or to love someone else, it starts with loving yourself. And when your heart is broken, isn't it that somehow that love is lost for self and is regaining it some piece of the healing process? Is that close enough? Okay.
I think you understand it better than I did.
Well, I'm your Pema tonight. It's so funny. I wrote an article about this today. Sort of. Hang on. Hold that thought, please. I understand, and I think it's completely valid, that wisdom traditions and psychologists say that it begins with loving yourself. And I think that's probably true. And when your heart is broken, you know, maybe you... You can feel like you're a bad person, you know, you're shame, like we were talking about earlier. So it is good to recover some kind of love of self. But the question to me is, how do you do that? I find that the most expeditious way to do that is to flip it and to love someone else. And then I start to love myself. That's been my experience, is that you don't have to start. It's not like you love yourself and then you can love others. For me, it's always been, I love someone else, then I love me. I don't know why. I see myself through their eyes. I see how much I want to give. And in some senses, this loving yourself is a concept. But then when you get engaged with another person, you see it in action and you feel it. And it's different than sitting and trying to rouse a kind of love for yourself. I don't think it's something you can feel. It's something that you do. And other people can be extremely generous in pointing out to you why you should do that. And so I think relationship is important to heal that. And healing that does not necessarily lead, you know, make you more... ready for a relationship. Is that useful in any way? Metz?
Yes.
Okay, that's very kind. Thank you. Yes and yes.
Isn't paying attention...
I'll repeat it.
Isn't paying attention without self-judgment loving yourself to your experience? So... it is like the first stage. Of essentially, if you don't know where you are, you're lost. And probably in some way distracted, avoiding. And so you're not centered. So to me, even though it's profoundly painful to be there. That's the only place to begin, and that is the self-love, if you will.
That is very beautifully said, and I'll try to say it as beautifully. Isn't sitting with yourself, with your feelings, yourself, without judgment, self-judgment, love, and I would say yes. So that just begs the question, and we'll have time for one more, and that will be you. What is this love? How do you know when you love yourself? How do you know when you love someone else? What is love made of? If you were to turn your attention to love, if you were to try to find love, like Elizabeth tried to find her anger, where would it be? So, you know, on one hand, this is a koanish kind of question, a good contemplation. But on the other hand, I think it has an answer. So, but just think to yourself, what is it? And it has to do with what this gentleman said. It has to do with attention. And John Tarrant Roshi, the Zen priest and poet, said, attention is the most basic form of love. Through it we bless and are blessed. And I think that's true. You know, if the unit of measure of, I don't know, what units of measure do you people use? Liters. What makes up a liter?
Something like a quart.
Milliliters. Okay, if milliliters are the units of a liter, if milliliters are, what's the word I'm looking for? You know what I mean. If milliliters go to make a liter, then the unit of love is attention. So think of it, I think that's true. Because without this attention, you're having some kind of situation with yourself. Mm-hmm. So one more.
It's okay.
He passed. Is that one more?
Isn't loving oneself also called simply Maitri?
Isn't loving oneself simply called Maitri? Maitri, Maitri, Sanskrit word that means loving kindness. The metta is the Pali word that some people know it by. Yeah, well, yes. And no. The practice starts with self-love. Always. You start when you try to rouse loving kindness through this traditional practice for all beings. You start with yourself. And that's, for us in the West, I think, particularly hard to do. I think when the Buddha or whoever made up this practice, that wasn't so hard for the people of that time to go, oh yeah, of course you're supposed to love yourself. But for us, for whatever reason, there's a lot of baggage. It's loaded. But that's where the practice starts. So I highly recommend it. And like I said, I mentioned earlier, I have instruction on my website, and it's not easy to find. So if you go looking for it, you can't find it, please email me. My website is susanpiver.com, and my email is on there. And we have our final step, which is to dedicate the merit. But first, I want to thank you so much. I want to thank you for your rapt attention. I could really feel it. And I appreciate it very, very much. So thank you for being here. And so to dedicate the merit, there's traditional way, and those of us who know the traditional way will chant it. But all it means is you rouse a sense of whatever you experienced, whatever you gained, whatever you felt, good, bad. You learned something, you were disappointed by it, you felt worse, you felt better. Whatever it is, you just rouse the sense of what came to you during our practice together, which includes our conversation, and you give it away, dedicate it, so that it could be of benefit to all beings. And all beings includes you. So you don't have to feel like, oh, everybody gets this but me. You dedicate it so that it could, even if you have no clue how this could be useful to other beings, but you dedicate it anyway. And Sakyong Lipam Rinpoche says, not dedicating the merit at the end of your practice is like akin to not hitting the save function in your Word document before shutting it down. You don't know where that document's going. But here we get to put a clean edge. Is everybody good with that? So people who know it will say it. Those who don't can just listen, or within, just dedicate the merit in your own way. Okay? By this merit, may all...